Hi, I'm Tamar Rodney, and you're listening to On the Pulse, a podcast from the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing. On this podcast, we take a deep dive into the experiences of frontline providers and researchers. We explore their insights and invaluable stories of how healthcare works in today's world. Today's podcast will cover mental health. Our guest is Johns Hopkins School of Nursing Assistant Professor Emma Mangano. Emma is a family psychiatric and mental health nurse practitioner with expertise in inpatient and emergency psychiatry, dual diagnosis, and geriatric behavioral health. Emma, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Now, May is Mental Health Month, and mental health is an issue that we hear a lot about in the news, but it might be also something that people don't fully understand. Can you tell us what exactly is mental health?
This is a really difficult question because we all have different ideas of what mental health is. Just like we have physical health, your health status might be different from mine, but we might both believe that we're in good physical health. And we may have a medical diagnosis like high blood pressure or diabetes, but if it is managed and we're taking the correct steps to keep our sugar level low or our blood pressure low, then we can say we're in relatively good physical health. And so the same concept applies for mental health. Generally speaking, mental health is not about being without illness, like major depression or an anxiety disorder, but being able to be productive, fulfill our daily activities, maintain good relationships with our family and our friends, and in stressful situations, being able to cope and manage in a healthy way.
Thank you for that. Would you say mental health is something that we hear more about now than we have previously before?
I do think it is that we're hearing more about it. And I'm glad that we are. It's a field that I've been in for over 15 years, and I don't think I have seen it talked about as much as we have in the past couple of years. Just unfortunate because we have always known the impact of mental health has had on us, and the mental health crisis is not new. This is something that I saw every day when I was working in the emergency room. So we know that depression is one of the leading causes of disability. Suicide has been one of the top causes of death among adolescents and young adults. So again, this is not anything that is new to us. And I hate to tie everything back to the pandemic, but this is probably one reason we are hearing about it more. It was something that disrupted or impacted so many people's lives globally altogether. This was not just an isolated event in one part of the world or one community. And so it really shed light on topics like health inequities, access to care, the importance of socialization, especially in our children, and really the list could go on. So all these things really were under a microscope for the past 2 years. And now we're seeing the outcomes in a different way. So again, the idea of mental health and just didn't appear overnight, but I think we're finally seeing the importance of it through a new lens.
I think a lot of persons would agree with you that it's unfortunate that we're hearing about it now more, but it's also a good thing because it offers much more publicity where it's needed. And it goes without saying that mental health would be different for different individuals, but could you describe for us how would you say it differs by age or demographics and social determinants of health?
So I think age and demographics are probably too broad to talk about how it differs within these groups. You'll probably need a whole other episode just to cover it. But social determinants of health kind of help cover all these differences we see within age and demographic groups, because these are the conditions that people live, places that people work, play, and so on. So this might help conceptualize it a bit more. All the 10-year-olds in Baltimore do not live on the same block, but all over the city. And the community and the environment they live in can differ so much from one neighborhood to the other, and sometimes even within blocks of each other. And so what I can do is I can elaborate a bit more on the impact of neighborhoods and communities, which is one of the social determinants of health. We all want to live in safe environments, whether that means little to no violence, access to healthy drinking water, or parks and outdoor space. We can probably take each of these things individually, each of these topics, and find a connection in the research to the impact it has on mental health, including healthy drinking water. And then there is access to healthcare. Can you drive to your appointment? Do you need to rely on public transportation? When the pandemic hit and buses stopped running, did people have access to good internet or smartphone to get on their telehealth appointments? And if a provider wasn't able to see someone, how did we intervene early enough to prevent decompensation or a change in mental health? And we can't just ask people to get up and move, so we have to be advocates for public policy to improve our health, which is kind of the driving force behind social determinants of health.
Could you tell us a little bit about some of the details that you just shared around access to things like drinking water? Could you tell us a little bit more about how that would affect an individual's health and their social determinants of health?
You know, healthy drinking water, drinking water is very important for healthy living and good physical health. But if we don't have access to healthy drinking water, there's some research that shows it can increase levels of anxiety. It can affect your mood. So just something as simple as being able to get a glass of water from your tap is really important for not only just our physical health, but our overall well-being. We talk about food deserts. If you don't have access to healthy water, then can you go to a grocery store and buy bottles of water? Which of course, then we talk about things such as inequities for food and being able to access that as well. So it's kind of this loop that we get into and we can get stuck in. So when we think about our social determinants of health, we have to think about the neighborhoods, we think about access, we think about economics. So everything just really kind of rolls in together. And this all impacts not just our physical health, but our mental health.
And thank you so much for taking the time to explain that, because I think it's such a complex issue and so many different things that contribute to good health, good mental health, but we rarely get a chance to think about that. And Emma, you have a very interesting role. You work at the Johns Hopkins Hospital and within psychiatric services, and there's a psychiatric emergency room. Can you tell us what this role looks like? And maybe just share for us what a typical day would look like for you.
Sure. This is such an interesting role and position, and I really love it. I got to develop this role back in 2015 because we never had a psychiatric MP in the psychiatric area before. So it was a great learning opportunity for me to really kind of develop a new position. Before the pandemic, we would see around 500 patients a month in our area, and about 30% of those patients who needed an admission. I won't talk about how long they would stay in the emergency department, but it was not just a few hours. And so we created this role to help take care of boarding patients or those who are evaluated and waiting in the ED for an admission to an inpatient psychiatric unit. This patient population would stay in the emergency department much, much longer than those waiting for a medical bed in the hospital. And so there was a higher risk for a patient's condition to get worse before they were getting admitted and beginning treatment. And of course, the goal of coming to the hospital is not to get worse, it's to get better. And so what happened is that we decided that we needed a provider to be able to be there every day and take care of this patient population. It really became important that this group was receiving the care that they would expect at Johns Hopkins. And so I would see this population every day, manage their treatment, write progress notes. It was almost like we would say running a little mini inpatient unit in the emergency room. And so this is what's also drove my DMP project, which focused on quality improvement. So I created also an order set that focused on treating patients with psychosis, since they have even longer stays in the emergency department than those without. And we saw good outcomes. We saw that patients were experiencing less symptoms than when they arrived, which is a no-brainer, really, when you think about it, that we would expect patients to get better if we're starting treatment. So that's what we did. We just started initiating treatment, and that was historically something that we did not do.
That's very interesting, and I'm happy that individuals have access to a nurse practitioner emergency room. But would you say this model of nurse practitioners in a psychiatric emergency room is something that exists nationally, or should it exist nationally?
It does not exist nationally. I think that this is a really good opportunity to see the role that we can play in taking care of this patient population. No, we really focus on improving outcomes, evidence-based practice, and providing that level of care. And so a lot of our community emergency rooms do not have access to a psychiatrist or psychiatric nurse practitioner. And a lot of them rely on calling in somebody or having somebody have to come in for a consult. You know, they could be waiting 6 hours, 8 hours for somebody to come to the emergency room. So this idea of having what I like to call kind of an embedded consult service within the emergency department is such a great idea, because you do get them that access to care right away. And not only are you just getting them seen, but we can start treatment as well. And the goal is that if we can start treatment sooner, then really we might even be able to avoid admissions, because there's just such a lack of mental health beds that we might be able to get somebody better and well and back into the community before they even have to be admitted.
That's so true. And I guess it speaks to a larger issue around access to care. And we have lots of research that signifies that mental health is increasing among children and among adults. Would you say in general that individuals are getting the care that they need, or do we have enough access to mental health care?
I would say that things are improving. Again, in the almost 10 years that I've been in the emergency department, I have seen policies put into place, protocols put into place that is definitely increasing access to outside the hospital care. again, we want to avoid admissions. We don't want people to be coming into the hospital. We want people to stay out in the community. And we are definitely seeing a lot more recovery programs. We're seeing more outpatient providers. There still are not enough. There's still a long wait. You know, you're still waiting 3 months, 6 months to see a provider. Again, not to go down some kind of rabbit hole, but then we have to start talking about insurance, and that can play a big role too in getting access to care. A lot of times patients have a public insurance or they don't have health insurance, and a lot of outpatient providers these days are taking private insurance or are self-pay, and many of our patients aren't able to do that. So there is still this balance that we're trying to find, but I do think that the access is improving as we've had this microscope under the mental health crisis and seeing what we need. And so I think we are getting there.
What could nurses specifically do to improve access to mental health care?
The American Psychiatric Nurses Association has a really good position statement about this, and it's titled, "Whole Health Begins with Mental Health." And so I really want to quote them because I think they say it so well. And so what they say is, "Mental health promotion through prevention, recognition, and adequate care and treatment must be at the starting point of and comprehensively woven throughout the delivery of services within the American healthcare system." So I think that's really, I don't think I could say it better than they have. And so nurses, it's our job to make sure we're doing this. It's part of our core values to not just be taking care of a diagnosis, but the whole person, their family, their community. And we need to make it part of our practice that we think of someone's mental health and well-being, just as we would take their temperature or blood pressure on each encounter and visit. I think back to my nursing school days when we talked about pain being the sixth vital sign. And sometimes I think that we might need to change our thinking a little bit around that. And maybe we need to think about, how is mental health? Is mental health part of that vital sign cluster? Because it has such an impact on our physical health. And so something just as simple as asking somebody how they're doing that day or how are they feeling can just be such a therapeutic question for our patients.
I think if mental health become one of our seventh vital sign, right, we'll give you credit for that. Let us expand this a little bit. If we could go to individuals and their family members and more general to the community, what are some of the things that our community members could do to ensure that we have better or positive mental health outcomes?
So individually, I think we need to be able to give ourselves the opportunity to ask for help. There's still so much stigma on mental health that there's still this fear of going and actually asking for help or asking somebody, like it might be a sign of weakness. And we really need to get past that idea. We need to tell ourselves that this is not a sign of weakness, because honestly, asking for and recognizing that we need help or support is a lot harder than thinking that it's going to go away on our own and it'll just go by and ignoring it. And when you're on the receiving end, whether you're a family member, a provider, you have an influence in the community, we need to be able to create the space for this to happen. One thing I always teach is how we as nurses can be a therapeutic tool, but you don't really have to be a nurse to do this. Anyone can be a therapeutic tool. All we have to do is just make ourselves present. So it's about making the space for someone to open up and be vulnerable. So think about the last time someone asked you how you were doing. Were you honest? Did you say you were fine and just move on to something else? And kind of vice versa, when you last asked someone that, were you just secretly hoping that they would say that they're okay and that they're fine and then move on as well? So I don't understand why we can't create these times in our days to really sit down, reflect, and talk about what is going on.
I guess it's a good message to say when we do ask or give an opportunity to say how we're doing, where we take that to be an honest learning and sharing opportunity. I do have another question for you, and it kind of ties in how we started. Social media, continuous consumption of the news, it's become more and more and it's more present. And it's a good problem because it's a place that we get to share mental health and put more spotlight on mental health. But in that we consume a lot, do you think it promotes good mental health, or should we be doing this, consuming this much news, or is there detriments to this process?
Yes, it's such a love-hate relationship with social media. Like you mentioned, social media has really kind of brought a spotlight to mental health. We have celebrities out there talking about mental health and really advocating for patients and access to care. So on one side, social media has been really helpful in this sense. But at the other side, you know, we have this idea of making everything look perfect on social media and this lack of reality. And we forget what kind of impact that can have on, especially our children or adolescents who are still developing, still trying to understand who they are. They're still growing and becoming individuals, and they see other things and they might have an unrealistic idea of what they are supposed to be or strive to be. So in that sense, you know, there can be some issues of trying to hit this ideal world that maybe is not realistic. And perhaps behind the scenes, we don't know what's going on with that social media person. For adults, I think the access to, it's the same thing. You know, we see the same idea of, we talk about FOMO, the fear of missing out, but we have to remember that so much of social media is just kind of showing the side that we want everybody to see. And there's other sides to us that we don't necessarily see. And that's unfortunate because I think we all have sides to us that we need to let other people see. And the news, I won't even touch on the news. I feel like we don't have a good news channel and we should have a good news channel, but just seeing everything on TV, and I don't think that this has really changed much through the years. What we see on the news is always kind of some kind of violence or war. It's just now we can get these pop-up alerts on our phones and we can get these pop-up alerts on our iPads. So now instead of just going home and watching the news when we want, we're getting it throughout the day. I think can also have an impact on us.
Yeah, so I think what we're touching on is probably responsible consumption, which might be a larger topic for us to deal with. Thank you for sharing your thoughts on that. And since May is Mental Health Month, as we mentioned, do you have any final words of hope for us?
I think one thing that we need to realize is that we're all humans. We all have emotions and we need to be able to recognize those and know when to ask for help and that to understand that it's okay to ask for help. And we need to be able to support that more, whether it's in schools, the community, at work.
I think a lot of persons need to hear that. It's okay not to be okay, and it's definitely okay to ask for help. Emma, I want to thank you again for joining us today. I am glad that there's more recognition of the importance of mental health and that there are things that we can do individually and collectively to live healthier, happier lives.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you to everyone for listening to this episode of On the Pulse. If you enjoyed this podcast, please share with someone you know and subscribe through Apple, Stitcher, and Spotify. You can also find us on the Health Podcast Network at healthpodcastnetwork.com/nurse. Be sure to also check out our On the Pulse blog. You can learn more about the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing at nursing.jhu.edu. Thanks again for listening.